All right, I think we're almost back on time, so I'll just press right on through. My name is Stephen McMillan. I'm a doctoral student here at SSA, also an alum of the master's program. And I'm very happy to be introducing our next speaker because her research touches on what I think of in part as the problem of successful evidence-based practice. And part of this problem is that a buzz builds, and we hear about successful practice, we talk about it, we say, oh yeah, when the topic comes up. And in some ways, evidence-based practice can become a brand name. We look for it, we feel kind of reassured when we see it, and then we often stop thinking that the practice invoked needs continued testing, continued research. We become de facto cheerleaders sometimes for the successful program without knowing much about how it is successful and how it is not. And our next speaker has done a great deal of research warning of this danger of becoming a cheerleader before all the evidence is examined. She reminds us that negative and null findings are just as important as positive findings and a rigorous examination of the evidence. And we know that confirmation bias, publication bias, often mean that these findings are not readily available. A comprehensive review of all the evidence might mean going beyond what evidence is easily located, easily accessible, even though this takes more time, costs more money, and might not be a RefWorks EndNotes direct export with one click of your mouse into your bibliography. So an ongoing reform of our research practices might be necessary, given what real evidence really looks like now. And our next speaker will share with us how to avoid some of the systematic research errors that are easy to make in our point-and-click society today. This is a lot more work, but I, for one, am relieved that I get to do it. In my study of evidence-based practice, I have felt the pressure that we've talked about today, compelled to take sides, to be either the quantitative cheerleader or the qualitative attack dog, the numbers guy or the critical philosopher. Our speaker today has demonstrated throughout her work that the critical thinking demanded by evidence-based practice also demands and insists upon thoughtful criticism. Evidence-based practice is semper reformanda, always reforming, always in need of reform, and that makes it an exciting field for social work research today. A 1992 alumna of the SSA doctoral program, Professor Julia H. Littell is professor in the Graduate School of Social Work and Social Research at Bryn Mawr, a member of the Campbell Collaboration Steering Group, and co-chair and coordinating editor of Campbell's Social Welfare Group. Her new book, Systematic Reviews and Meta-Analysis, came out this past year. Professor Littell is a leading expert on the use and misuse of research findings, and her speaking engagements on evaluating evidence have taken her to Australia, China, Denmark, and Ireland. Professor Littell just returned from Norway, where she was plenary speaker at the Campbell Collaboration Annual Colloquium, and this summer she will conduct a series of workshops for the New Zealand government's Ministry of Youth Development. Given this busy schedule, we are very fortunate to have with us today Professor Julia H. Littell.
Thank you, Steve. And thanks to Tina and the members of the organizing committee. It's really, really nice to be back home. It's been a long time. I'm going to rely heavily on slides because I'm a real visual learner, and I hope you can see them. We'll find out. Let's see. So this is the title of my talk, Evidence-Based or Biased, and Why Methods of Research Synthesis Matter. I'm going to argue that I'm not sure we have many evidence-supported interventions, not even in psychology, and at least we should be careful about the assumptions we make. So what I want to do, just this is sort of an overview, is go back to this idea that there are two views of evidence-based practice that Tina described very clearly, and argue that they're both based in part on the process of research synthesis. And then I'll describe to you three different approaches to research synthesis and show you that they lead to different conclusions about what the evidence means. And this is not accidental. I think there's some systematic patterns here, and I'll talk about what they are. And I'll do that by walking you through a very simple example from the literature and from my work, and then tell you why I think review methods matter, talk about the science of research synthesis. There really is a science here that is not used much in social sciences, not just in social work, but not in psychology either. And what that means for the need for valid information for policy and practice. Okay, I can hardly see this. I hope you can. Back to this idea that there's two different views of evidence-based practice. I was really happy to hear that people here are all on the same page and focusing on the process, the verb. That's the one that's closest to my heart. But I do think, and it, you know, comes from David Sackett's writing on evidence-based medicine and developed by Len Gibbs and Phil Davies for Policy and Practice. But I think when people, even social work academics, talk about evidence-based practice, you sometimes hear them slip between these two very quickly and even in the same sentence, and it really is a concern. So the other way of thinking about it, and there are, it's not just a dichotomy, as Sharon would say, but another major way of thinking about it is to think about the noun or the products, these empirically supported interventions, empirically based practices, plural. And Len Gibbs said that when you take the term empirically based practice and you make it plural, you have changed the subject. And you're no longer talking about the same thing. And in fact, you might be talking about something that's not even compatible with the process. Now, I'll talk about that a bit more. These evidence-based practices are those programs, policies, interventions that meet certain criteria and standards. I think Jean mentioned a few of these, or someone mentioned a few of these earlier. Here are a few more sources of these evidence-based practices, plural. Blueprints for Violence Prevention identifies programs as promising or model. The Substance Abuse and Mental Health Service Administration has a slightly different way of categorizing programs based on empirical evidence of effects. SPR has standards. And the most influential schema, I think, is the American Psychological Association, its Clinical Psychology Division, Division 12. They identify probably efficacious and well-established treatments. And as Harold said, the criteria to get on this list is to have two randomized controlled trials showing evidence of positive effect on any outcome measure or on, and if there are 20, it's not a good, I'll argue that there are much better ways of identifying the effects of interventions. But these are the dominant model in the United States. This is a very American way to look at evidence-based practice. But it's being imported into other countries, as other countries are taking these empirically supported interventions and trying to implement them in very different contexts, often without success. Sometimes with success. But in any case, and you can hear my bias, and I think it's one that we share, whether you are interested in this sort of bottom-up practice or a top-down imposition of empirically supported treatments, both of these approaches depend in part on a synthesis of research evidence. So whether you're a clinician, you know, looking for research, whether you're a team in the way that you've worked in agencies looking for research, whether you're that Oregon policymaker or whoever wrote that legislation, and it's not just in Oregon, but it's also New York, Florida, Washington State, and Iowa, saying that agencies must use interventions off lists of evidence-based practices, you are depending on some synthesis of the research evidence. Okay? We've been doing this for hundreds of years, actually, synthesizing research evidence. Now, we focused mostly on evidence about efficacy and effectiveness, and as others have said, these are not the only issues that are important in evidence-based practice. I think Jean mentioned five questions that are important. Mm-hmm. Now, I'm going to talk about effectiveness, but it's not because I think this is the most important question. It's because it has received the most attention in this field, and I think we can do a much better job of synthesizing this evidence. So the idea of research synthesis, of course, is to combine results from multiple studies. And generally, people would agree that's a good thing, because you get more compelling evidence than you would get from any single study. You get replication or refutation of early findings. And on top of that, it's an opportunity to look at what works best for whom across studies and perhaps generate some hypotheses about why effects might differ in one place versus another. For instance, the program that I'm most interested in has been developed here in the United States, but when you put it into Sweden, it doesn't work at all. Well, why not? That's a good question. So Mark Lipsey wrote this famous article in 1997 called What Can You Build with Thousands of Bricks? And he was complaining that studies pile up, that research piles up and it sort of lies around and we're really not doing much with it that's systematic. And he said, and he's been a big proponent of systematic reviews and meta-analysis, he said that by combining the results of the studies, we can develop better theories of intervention and develop better ideas about how to develop programs and evaluate them. And this is a similar theme was picked up by Ian Chalmers, who's the early leader of the Cochrane Collaboration, who wrote that science is cumulative, but scientists rarely accumulate evidence scientifically. And we can do that. There are ways to do that. Just an aside, I was really struck by Jennifer's point about how, I guess I would use the word hypocritical it is, for social scientists to tell practitioners to, you know, use our research when social scientists aren't using the science about how you synthesize studies.
Uh-oh.
Whoops. Okay, so what can we build with a whole bunch of studies? What can we build with 1,000 bricks? Well, all kinds of things. I mean, all kinds of things.
Mm-hmm.
How do we do it? What are the blueprints? What are the raw materials, and what methods are used to combine results across studies? Okay, that's the main focus here. Well, first of all, the blueprints. Plans for a research review vary a lot from one review to the next in terms of the amount of planning that goes into it ahead of time versus, you know, let's see what we find out and what's on PsycINFO. They vary a lot in terms of their transparency and rigor. And there are basically three different approaches with some overlap among them that I'm calling traditional narrative reviews, systematic reviews, and meta-analysis.
Mm-hmm.
So a traditional narrative review is something that we've all done. I've done many of them, which you take what I'm calling a convenient sample of published studies. What does that mean? It means you go to your laptop or your library terminal, and you go to a bibliographic database, and you type in keywords, and up come a convenient sample of published studies. Now, it's a convenient sample because if you go to a different database, you get a different result. If you go to the same database from a different institution, different portal, you get a different result. It's convenient because these are the studies that popped up using your keywords, and if you use a different phrase, you'd get something else. And you're only getting published studies. And I'll show you that there's some real problems with that. Okay, so that's what you do. Let's say I pull up, go to PsycINFO, type in juvenile delinquents. I get 10 studies at the top of my list. I throw out a couple that, don't have findings they have findings I don't like, or that were done too long ago, or I don't know. If you're reading my review of these studies, you don't know how I selected studies. Okay? All of a sudden, you've got some sample. Here's this reviewer describing now 8 studies that she found in PsycINFO. Okay, I'm exaggerating. We are getting better than that. But then what I do is I give you a narrative description of each study. Okay, I say, here's what the studies did, here's where they were conducted, here's what they found. And somehow, in my mind, I add them up. And when I do this in a formal way, it's called vote counting. But I'm using some form of cognitive algebra to tell you, to synthesize the results. And I'll tell you, most studies found that, you know, juvenile delinquents go on to do okay. Most is a proportion. How did I get that? You have no idea. Or if I'm being systematic about it, I'll say, you know, 4 out of 5 studies said this and another one said that, okay? But when I'm doing that, when I'm counting what studies say, I'm usually counting statistically significant results, right? So let's say out of my 8 studies, 6 found that a program had statistically significant effects and 2 didn't. Okay, I would argue that I'm counting the wrong thing. Statistical significance depends a lot on the size of samples. So if my studies are very small, they're not going to show significant results. If they're very big, everything's going to be significant. What we care about is the size and the nature of the effect, not statistical significance. So excuse me a second. Now, we have been getting better at this, and now typically when you see a review, you see that researchers are looking at multiple databases. They're trying to become more transparent about how they selected studies. But this process is still vulnerable to many sources of bias that are well documented in the literature. And I want to talk about them because these are the biases that you're going to encounter whether you're a clinician looking for information on in some database, or a program developer, or a researcher. And the first is publication bias. Now, there's a large body of literature, and what I'm citing here are reviews of this literature in different fields, going back 30 years, really, that shows this, that studies with statistically significant results are statistically significantly more likely to be published than those with non-significant results, all other things equal. Now, accounting for study quality and design, all right? And this is actually a complex problem. Now, for years, journal editors and peer reviewers have been blamed for that. You know, you only publish the statistically significant stuff. But that's really not the problem. Kay Dickerson has shown that the problem lies mostly with researchers. And I found this to be true in my research. The first problem is that researchers don't think that their null results are worthwhile. So I interviewed the PI of a very important study in the area that I'm working on, probably the best study in the field. 400 families and four sites, and they found no differences between two treatments. And I called him up and I said, why have you not published this? And he said, well, we didn't find anything. And I said, yeah, you did. You did the biggest, most rigorous randomized controlled trial using standardized measures, and you found that two treatments had equivalent effects. That means that clinicians and program makers have a choice. That's news. He said, yeah, okay. But then the next problem, I don't expect anyone will publish this, so I'm not going to bother submitting it for publication, and I'm on to the next thing. So, and unfortunately, he's right. His chances of getting published are much lower. So there is evidence, again, going back 30 years, that peer reviewers and editors are less likely to accept null findings, even if they're just as good as significant results. Now, the problem is even more complicated in that once accepted for publication, studies with significant results are published faster. So if you have two studies equal in all respects, except that one has significant results and the other doesn't, the one with the null findings is going to have a longer lag to print. Okay, there's a Hopewell has shown that with a systematic review of research in this area. Studies with significant results are cited and reprinted more often. They're more likely to be published in English than in other languages. And that's because if I'm a German language researcher and I complete a study, if it has null results, I'm going to send it to my German language publication. If it has significant results, I think it has a better chance in an English language publication. So what all this means is that if you're searching for information from studies in English, the significant results are going to be overrepresentative. You don't get a representative sample of the research. And then there's this phenomenon called outcome reporting bias that shows that when studies have mixed results, those statistically significant ones are more likely to be reported, that is, mentioned at all. And even when researchers report non-significant results, they're likely to suppress the data. So they're not going to provide data on null results. Another issue here that I think affects our literature that's a very sort of a ubiquitous problem is confirmation bias. And this is the tendency to seek and accept information that confirms our prior expectations or hypotheses and ignore information to the contrary. I think this is just a very human problem that we are information that's consistent with what we already believe is just easier for us to process and take in, and it's harder to challenge our own beliefs. And this is sort of like somebody mentioned before, Murphy's Law of Research. If you look hard enough, you'll find evidence to support anything you want. And then there's some other biases in the literature that are documented. In the review process, selection bias is a problem, in that certain properties of studies or reports of studies affect how reviewers recall and evaluate that information. And sometimes those properties are pretty trivial. So that's not good. All in all, Doug Altman has shown that these publication and reporting biases appear to be cumulative. They're systematic. They're not working against each other. They're all working in one direction, and that direction is to inflate effect sizes. I think, and my colleagues in the Campbell and Cochrane collaboration would agree, that these biases are ubiquitous, but they're often ignored, especially in research reviews. So better blueprints, better ways to compile the literature. Systematic reviews are designed for this purpose in that they aim to minimize these biases in the review process, and other biases actually as well. So for each review, the reviewers develop and publish a detailed protocol in advance. A protocol is developed specifically for that review, just as if you were starting a research project. You know, you have a plan in advance. In this case, it is published so that later on, when the review is done, readers can tell whether the plan was followed. Systematic reviews use well-documented, replicable procedures to find, assess, and synthesize evidence. And these include setting explicit criteria for studies that will and will not be included in advance, and again, putting them in writing in advance. So I can't just, you know, omit a couple studies that had findings that I didn't like. If I do that, I've already published my criteria for findings, and someone can say, why didn't you include that study? This meets your criteria. So it holds us accountable. We have systematic strategies for locating relevant studies, especially in the gray literature. And we systematically extract data from eligible studies, seeking inter-rater agreement on decisions about whether specific studies are eligible for our review, on how data are extracted for the review, and on what the data mean. And that's really important because I've worked with a lot of doctoral students in coding research studies, and sometimes the methodology sections in these studies are so terse that it's very hard to tell what they did. And two very smart people reading the same study might not have the same understanding of what happened. We do a formal study quality assessment that is not based on research design, but based on what we call risk of bias. How likely is it that this study is going to produce credible or biased information? And there's a whole body of literature on that. And then we use meta-analysis when it's possible and appropriate to synthesize results across studies of treatment outcomes. Just quickly, meta-analysis, you probably know, is a set of statistical procedures used to assess average effects across studies. That's usually the least interesting thing about it. It can also be used to tell you what kinds of variations in effects there are across studies, and to help us identify potential sources of variation as well. And meta-analysis also includes tests for risk of bias. There are statistical tests for publication bias, for example, to see if publication bias is likely in any sample of studies. It's actually pretty cool stuff. Now, some people think that systematic reviews and meta-analysis are the same thing, and they're really not. And they can be used together, but they're often not. So a systematic review does not have to include meta-analysis. It might include a narrative synthesis, perhaps because the quantitative data were not worth talking about or are very sparse. Some systematic reviews find no studies that meet their eligibility criteria. And in fact, the Cochrane collaboration publishes empty systematic reviews. These are reviews of interventions that found no studies conducted that of any rigor that can be synthesized. That's important information. And the National Health Service in the UK basically wants to see one of those empty reviews before it will fund new trials. They want to see a systematic review of the evidence that shows there's not evidence out there already. So also meta-analyses are often not based on systematic reviews. In fact, I think most of the published meta-analyses are not systematic reviews. Instead, they appear to use a convenient sample of published studies. They're not getting into the gray literature. And I think that's potentially a problem because that makes them vulnerable to all the publication and dissemination biases that we are concerned about with narrative reviews. So not all things that are called systematic reviews are systematic reviews. This is like evidence-based practice. Now this has become a new term and people are attaching it to everything. Actually, parenthetically, that process is called Sacketization. Do you know this? David Sackett found that Sacketization means using the term evidence-based practice to sell something. So now you have a much better chance of getting your review article published if you call it a systematic review. And I've seen systematic reviews that included a keyword search of PsycINFO. I'm sorry, that's not it. But standards, international interdisciplinary standards for systematic reviews are developed by the Cochrane Collaboration for Healthcare and the Campbell Collaboration for Social Welfare, Education, and Crime and Justice. And these are international interdisciplinary organizations. And so these standards are based on the science of research synthesis, that is, based on empirical evidence from systematic reviews of methodological research. So research on, you know, if I do a review that includes unpublished literature or a review that does not include published literature, what's the difference? There's evidence on that question, and the standards are based on that evidence. Anyway, these standards are described and elaborated in the Cochrane Handbook, which is available at the Cochrane website, cochrane.org, and in a new set of standards called PRISMA. I want to say that these standards are clearly not followed by the American Evidence-Based Practice Centers funded by AHRQ. They have a different set of standards, and one of them is don't include unpublished studies. Another is don't include studies conducted outside of the United States. These standards also are not used in any of the lists that I showed you before, the SAMHSA list, the blueprints, APA criteria. Those groups that publish lists of empirically supported treatments are doing that based on traditional narrative reviews for the most part. Sometimes there's a meta-analysis, but it's certainly not up to these standards. Okay, so that's about an overall approach to reviewing. Now, what about the raw material? The quality of evidence matters, okay? And so we need high-quality studies in order to produce a reliable review. It's the garbage-in, garbage-out problem, okay? Now, what constitutes a high-quality study depends very much on the question you're asking. And I would outright reject this idea of a design hierarchy where randomized controlled trials are at the top and then you work your way down to case studies. I outright reject that because it depends on your question. Now, if your question is about effects of interventions, you might like randomized controlled trials, but they can go bad too. They can produce unreliable information. So it's more complicated than that. Studies, unfortunately, are not like bricks. They're complex. They deal with multiple concepts and measures. So our task of combining them is quite complex. And in order to show you this on a more concrete level, let me walk you through an example. I'm going to start by describing one study that collected data on 30 outcomes. And let's see how the investigators compiled that information and showed it to us in a published report, and then how published reviews of that studies described that information. All right? So this is the study. It was published 20 years ago in the Journal of Consulting and Clinical Psychology, conducted by Molly Brunk and her colleagues, based on Molly Brunk's dissertation. The study is a comparison of multisystemic therapy or parent training in the treatment of child abuse and neglect. So this is a very small study, 43 families randomly assigned to either parent training groups or to multisystemic therapy. MST, which is a program I've been studying for a while, many of you know, is on all of these lists of effective programs. It is time-limited, in-home and community-based treatment for families with kids in trouble, either in the juvenile delinquency system or kids with psychiatric problems, and it is being used in child welfare as well. So comparing these two treatments for families, of the 43 families, 33 completed the treatment that they were assigned to and stuck around for the post-test, so we lost 10 along the way. And the investigators, because they were interested in many psychosocial and individual and family outcomes, collected data on 30 measures, and these are scales and subscales. Okay? So if we were to just roll the dice on these 30 outcome measures, okay, by chance we would find that one would favor the parent training group, I'm calling it the red team, and one would favor the MST group, the green team, and most would have no differences, okay, just by chance. Now here's what the investigators got on their outcome measures. Something different, not a lot. Okay, now to talk about how they built up conclusions based on this evidence, I'm organizing it like this. Can you all see this? Because if you can't, it's a shame. No? Okay. So what I've done basically are taken those blocks and just organized them. And so this study finds 2 outcomes that favor the parent training group, 5 that favor the MST group, and most that show that the groups are about equivalent on the outcome measures. Now, it's a small study. We're not going to find a lot of differences anyway, but that's what the data show. Okay, what do the investigators say about this? First, they give us a table in which they provide data on all of the statistically significant results and half of the non-significant results. That's outcome reporting bias, my friends. And if you're trying to do a meta-analysis, you've lost data on outcomes. Okay, but the only thing they've dropped are the null findings. Now, here is, I've done a content analysis of the phrases they used in the abstract to describe the results of the studies. And they identify 3 areas in which the groups showed improvements, but there were no real differences between groups. So both groups improved in terms of psychiatric symptoms and stress and severity of identified problems. So those are the 3 white blocks in the middle, findings of no difference, really. MST group did better at restructuring parent-child relations. PT was better at identifying, reducing social problems. So what they've got is a very balanced abstract, I would argue, with some missing data. All right, the problem comes in the research reviews. So let's see what the published reviews of this study said about it. Okay, first one, again, I've done content analysis of phrases the authors used in the text to describe the results of the study. And these authors described 3 domains in which the groups were similar and 2 in which the MST group was better. Okay? They also provide us with a table in which they make 1 statement, and that statement is, this study shows that MST improved parent-child relations, period. That's true. It's not the whole story. Okay, here's a different review, and they build a different building out of this data, but that's a very unusual one. Here's a meta-analytic review. These folks created an average effect size across all outcome measures and came up with an effect size, a D-index, of what is actually a huge number in this field, huge. And what it means is that if this is true, and I don't think it is, that the average MST case would have had to outperform 90% of the PT cases on an average conducted across all outcome measures. Mathematically, I don't see it. So meta-analysis is not always the solution. These guys did something terribly wrong. These are all of the published reviews that describe this study. Now, for each review I've shown in a line now, and you see the first 4 bars you've already seen in greater detail. Burns et al.'s narrative report, their one-item phrase in a table, the Cochrane review, which has a different balance to it. And then as you go on down, you see a pattern, and that is that most published reviews of this study use a single phrase to describe its results, and it favors Team Green. And some of these reviews are cited over and over and over again. Kasdan and Weiss, Hogwood, Burns. I mean, these are leaders in psychology. So the problem is they're using a single phrase to describe the results with advantages to one team. And what we've lost here is some valuable information on relative advantages and disadvantages and equivalent results of 2 different approaches to treatment. Okay, but they don't just, in these reviews, they don't just look at one study. They have multiple studies. So it's like dealing with a whole lot of Rubik's Cubes in which each study has many pieces of information. how do we add them up? Well, my students and I found, we did an analysis of reviews on the effects of MST published after 1996, and we found that there are more than 86 published reviews of this literature. And I'm not counting the little reviews that appear in the introduction to reports on studies themselves. There are 10 times more reviews than there are studies. And we found and assessed 66 of them, and of them found that many of the reviews did not cite a single primary study. They cited other reviews. So whether they may have looked at the original evidence, it's unclear whether they did. I published last year a detailed analysis of the 37 reviews that actually cited a primary study and found that most of them were traditional narrative reviews of a convenient sample of published studies. Most conclude that MST is consistently more effective than the alternatives to which it's been compared. And some, including some very famous people, conclude and maintain that the research shows that MST is superior to alternatives across problems, populations, and settings. Then these conclusions are repeated by others in the light reviews, including NIH State of the Science Consensus Statement, which actually commissioned a systematic review but chose to go with expert opinion instead of the results of the review. And others. So these conclusions have been repeated over and over again, and my hunch is that some of that repetition is being taken for replication, and it's been repeated so often that now many people will tell you, well, we already know that works, and the problem is we're not doing it. Well, very quickly, the scientific approach, and I'm out of time already, we did a systematic review of the research on meta-analysis, and it's published in the Cochrane and Campbell libraries. There's a series of articles on it in Children and Youth Services Review, including a debate with the MST developers, and we're updating that review now. Our systematic search included unpublished data. I'm going to skip some of this. This is basically what we come up with. Now, this is called a forest plot, and we're building the data one outcome at a time. So for every outcome that a study collected, we take that outcome and we build all of the studies that looked at that outcome. So this is these are measures of out-of-home placement, and all of the studies that looked at that outcome are represented here. We only combine conceptually similar outcomes, so we've kept incarceration separate from hospitalization, separate from another measure that's used in Sweden. But each little line represents a study. It's an effect size and its confidence interval, and the diamonds are averages. And what you see is that there's only one study that shows a significant effect, and overall, on average, there's no difference between MST and whatever it was compared to in terms of out-of-home placement, the major outcome variable. That's the same picture on every single outcome. We've got 21 of these in the published report. No significant difference overall on any outcome measure. We conclude the effects are not consistent across studies. There are very few studies, most of them conducted by program developers. All of the studies have mixed results, except the few studies that have null results on every single outcome measure. And that's not what you get from the literature. Okay, I need to move along quickly. These are well-meaning reviewers, and why do they get, I think they get this wrong. Why? Because they rely on sort of our natural methods to filter and synthesize data. With apologies to Sharon Berlin, who told us that we need complex models of brain if we're going to understand the mind. I'm using a very simple one, and that it's the human brain is good at some things and not so good at others, and that we're very good at detecting patterns, even sometimes when those patterns aren't there. And we're very good at maintaining the status quo. We're not so good at vigilance, really being careful to track something. We're not good at math, cognitive algebra. I love statistics, but don't ask me to count past 10. And we're not really good without assistance at challenging our own beliefs, which is why some of the cognitive work is so important, because it helps people challenge their own beliefs. But naturally, without that kind of aid, we don't do it. So I would argue that research synthesis is simply too complex for informal methods and unaided cognitive algebra, and we have to use a more systematic approach. I'm going to skip this stuff and tell you that although I've raised some concerns about biases in the literature, there are some important and very useful things going on now to counteract those. The World Health Organization is setting up a global platform for prospective registries of studies, with the idea that if investigators have to register their study in a public database at the IRB process, when they're registering their data collection protocol, then later on we'll know whether they reported all outcome measures and we'll be able to find missing data much more easily. They're also developing public data archives and so on. So again, this Tina showed and others showed a much more elegant and official diagram. I think it's the Haynes, Devereaux, and Guyot diagram. I'm showing you a much more rudimentary and concrete one, but just to show you that information on efficacy and effectiveness can only be used in context with other concerns. So from a practitioner's point of view or from a policymaker's point of view, what do you make of the evidence that MST is or is not better than the alternatives? Let me tell you how people have responded to that. In Sweden, they just completed a four-site trial comparing MST to treatment as usual, which is, we would call it intensive casework. This is Sweden we're talking about here. And they found no differences on any outcome measure. Okay? So in that circle, they say, okay, no differences. What do? They decide to keep MST because it's structured and the programs providers like that, clinicians like it, clients don't object, and they can afford it. I would say that's a defensible, empirically based decision. They've taken that piece of evidence, they've also put it in context and considered other values and come out with that decision. Others have decided not to use the intervention because it's too expensive, because clients don't like it, or for whatever reasons. And when the evidence is equivocal, that finding of no difference or we're not really sure actually frees us up to say we can't make a decision based on evidence of effects alone. And we're back to looking at these other concerns. So Kay Dickerson argues that evidence-based practice should really free us up to make choices. Informed choices. It should not restrict them. And systematic reviews can help in this enterprise by providing us with more accurate syntheses of what the empirical evidence really is. I would argue that this has to be used along with other information, and it should inform policy and practice, and systematic reviews should replace traditional reviews, and it should replace meta-analyses that are done as a standalone. So thank you for listening. Happy to take comments and questions, or it's late in the day.
Thank you. One of the benefits of getting to have this SSA Centennial is that over the course of the academic year, we've had a wide variety of symposia on almost every topic possible in social work. And as a result of that, I'm synthesizing myself. And part of my synthesis, with apologies to Gösta Esping Andersen, is I kind of feel like I'm in three worlds of evidence-based practice. And the first world is this philosophical critique that evidence-based practice is part of a post-welfare regime and it's just creating a very dark world. The second world is kind of what I'm thinking of as evidence-based commodity, that, you know, evidence-based practice equals big bucks, ka-ching, let's go. And now I feel like together at the end of the day, we're in this third world where we see a lot of value in evidence-based practice. We see a lot of challenge in implementation, mm-hmm. in statistical analysis. And so now I guess my broad question is, how do we make this third world bigger?
Wow, that's a great question. And I think there are lots of answers to that around the world, around the room. Well, I think by pointing out the dangers of using evidence-based practice as a noun or a product to impose on people programs that may or may not really have good empirical evidence behind them, to critique the evidence summaries that have been provided to us, and to, I think, do more of this. The agency-based work that Stan and Jennifer and Harold and others are doing, I think, is shows another, a more positive side of evidence-based practice. At the same time, we're also moving, much as I loved Len Gibbs, we're moving a little bit beyond his model, too. And that, I mean, he thought that individuals, practitioners, could do this. And we are all finding that that's just, they don't have the time, they struggle with making sense of the research, and they shouldn't have to do that. So I think we could make the evidence-based practice world bigger by dividing up the labor a little bit. I'd like to see the Campbell collaboration and Cochrane collaboration provide reliable syntheses of evidence that people can depend on. So you can go to that and say, okay, I know that's going to be reliable and unbiased. We're not there yet. And we're still in the infancy in figuring out how to do truly transparent reviews. That's difficult. These studies are hard to combine. And there are all kinds of issues around conflict of interest. You know. So let them synthesize the evidence. That's one thing. And then have agencies working in teams develop, you know, their programs using existing evidence and producing new evidence.
Actually, we will have
out
to...
Of time.
Yeah, we've run out of time. So if you have any more questions or comments, if you will be staying for the reception, feel free to discuss during that time. So we will move into the closing remarks.
Okay.
Thank you.